You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 24th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the three-time award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On today's program, columnist and journalist Rafia Zakaria on aid and stereotypes and dignity. How the Western relationship to aid to developing countries can fuel racism, disrupt local markets, hurt the global environment, and how we can right and correct those trends. We're also going to be talking about some of the latest developments in the situation for women's rights in Pakistan. Also
on the program, we have a few stories here. One, such as this one, where a certain senator thinks the Koch brothers are American heroes and patriots. Another story here, where we've got creationists demanding equal airtime on the latest show about science, the Cosmos. Creationists want equal airtime, folks.
I want my equal time at the semifinals of the U.S. Open this year.
Yes.
Where's my time?
Where's my time?
Where's my time in Arthur Ashe Stadium? What the hell?
We also have stories about how prisoners are being treated even worse now in the U.K.
It's a horrible story.
The latest, what's going on over in Ukraine, the Malaysian flight. Also, there's some news coming out of Egypt.
Yeah, I'll get to this actually really briefly, and then I'll tease a few more stories. But I just want to take just a 30 seconds, basically. But there's not really much more to talk about at this time. But look, if everybody's been following the situation in Egypt knows just how atrocious the past several months have been. On a human rights level, and the full kind of restoration of a military junta under General Sisi. And the kind of latest news that came out yesterday is that a court has sentenced 528 supporters of the former president Morsi, Mohamed Morsi, who was, of course, the president from the Muslim Brotherhood, who was deposed in a coup. 528 of his supporters have been sentenced to death by an Egyptian court. And this comes in conjunction with kind of mass arrests, roundups, and the killings that happened over the summer. So really dark days continue in Egypt. That's obviously something we'll continue to follow and talk about, but we wanted to at least take a brief amount of time to just kind of notate that. We're also going to talk Turkey, Prime Minister Erdogan shutting down Twitter and actually – get into a little bit of the context for why he's doing that. That's a pretty fascinating thing. Turkey has elections coming up. It's a fascinating, disturbing situation, but also interesting. We're going to talk about how activists have been evading the Twitter ban, and also what Erdogan is just so upset about. Also, Jimmy Carter, he only uses snail mail because he thinks the NSA is monitoring all of his communications, and with everything we're learning, he's probably right. Okay, there's also a bunch more, but we're going to take a brief break and come right back with Rafia Zakaria. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be right back.
The Magnificent Seven. Ring, ring, 7 a.m. Move yourself to go again. Cold water in the face brings you back to this awful place.
mortgage on your bankers too. Let's get up and learn those moves. Weatherman and the crazy chief. One says sun and one says sea. AM, the FM, the PM too. Turning out that boogaloo. Gets you up and I guess you out. But how long can you keep it up? Give me Honda, keep me Sonic. So cheap and we're falling. Hong Kong dollar, Indian cents, English pounds and Eskimo pence. Mind back, it's time for the bus. We got to work, and you're one of us. Folks go slow with a place of work. Minutes drag and the hours just. Yeah, well, bye-bye. Wave bye-bye to the boss. It's our profit, it's his loss. But anyway, the lunch bell rings. Take one out, do y'all.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
And I am Michael Brooks. And joining us now is Rafia Zakaria. She's a columnist for Dawn newspaper and Al Jazeera America. Rafia, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. So I want to talk. You wrote this great piece for Dawn that came out a couple of days ago called Aid and Stereotype, where you looked at the relationship between donor countries, basically, and the kind of the cultural underpinnings of how we look at aid or charity. And you started this the column off by talking about some very funny satiric videos that this organization in Norway has been putting out about aid. And I'm just wondering if you could what are those videos? What's going on in those videos, and how do they set the frame for your article and this discussion?
Well, thanks for having me on and letting me talk about this article. Now, as a columnist for a newspaper in Pakistan, you know, a country that has been an aid recipient for decades now, and whose collection of U.S. aid and specifically has been kind of at issue, I feel, almost every U.S. election. And I've covered a lot of the dimensions of these issues of aid and cultures that take aid, cultures that give aid. And what was fascinating to me about these videos, which are actually available on YouTube, they're produced by the Norwegian Association of Academics and Students for International Assistance. And I think actually if you just Google, I think Saving Africa Gone Wrong, you can get the video and the other ones. And to, just so that your listeners would know, for example, one of them is a spoof on, a little African boy who's basically a child actor, and he's playing that, what he himself calls sad African in this video. Another one features Africans collecting radiators to send to Norway because it's so cold there. So they're trying to send some warmth from Africa over to Scandinavia, to Norway. And what's good about them is that they play on what has become the image of Africa in the Western imagination. And the question that I've focused on in that piece is whether these stereotypes are essential to invoke compassion from people. Mm-hmm. And to expand sort of the territory of that, I spoke not only about global South and global North differences, right? So the West giving aid to Africa or Asia, but also within these countries. So within Pakistan, for example, we've had a famine that has happened in the past month in interior Sindh, in the province that I'm from. And there have been very similar images of people starving, of malnutrition, children, of really abject conditions. And the question is, how can we preserve the dignity of people and the humanity of people who are aid recipients? And, you know, the answer is a complicated one because, you know, when, and I know this as someone who's worked in advocacy, both aid and human rights advocacy, is that unfortunately when you're making an appeal for help, you end up presenting problems in a very black and white framework. You know, you don't want the person that you're asking assistance from to have doubts about who's right and who's wrong in this situation. It's a very emotional appeal to compassion. But the question for journalism, of course, is that, you know, that's the advocacy demand in the world that we exist in. But can journalists tell more complicated stories that really give the context of why these disasters arise, the fact that the complicity of different people in those situations is not often as black and white, you know, and that it's not as simple as just sending food or just sending immediate assistance.
So, yeah. Sorry, go ahead. Finish your thought. Sorry.
Oh, it's just so you know, there's an ethical issue underlying all of this. I mean, do we prioritize the immediate concerns of the victims that we see? Do we continue to sort of objectify them? And, you know, we live in a very visual world right now with Instagram and social media. And the danger, of course, is that we're reducing people who need assistance to these images that then inform our, you know, our knowledge about those areas and those people in different ways that go beyond that context.
Absolutely. And you did a great job of describing this. And we kind of pull out a couple of different threads of this. And one of the things that actually reminded me, I thought of when I was reading this piece I remembered a course I took in college on Buddhist theory, actually. And there was this terminology in Buddhism where they talk about desirable traits and then the near enemies of desirable traits, which can be confused with those desirable traits. So as an example, compassion is a very desirable trait, but pity is not. Equanimity is a desirable trait, but indifference is not. And the thing that kind of kept coming up for me as I was reading this, as reading your piece, was that maybe this kind of reductive pity that we usually get when we're kind of sold and presented these images, as you say, is very dehumanizing. And I guess there's a couple of different threads that you go with this, that both of which you raise. So on one hand, you also talk about and what these videos that you mentioned from Norway also satirize is, in some respects, actually getting more specific and serious about the particulars of aid. So just kind of sending old clothes and discarded electronics and campaign posters or whatever, that might make you feel good. But actually, in most cases, that could just be contributing to local waste or environmental problems or disrupting local distribution networks. And that's a very concrete way that shows up. So could you elaborate on that aspect of it as well?
Yeah, I mean, first, of course, I think that the distinction that you're making between pity and compassion is absolutely crucial to this issue. And I think that what I was trying to do, and then the piece actually that's written by Sindre Edlund at Al Jazeera America, who works for this organization and wrote about making the videos, both of them point to this issue of, you know, how can aid organizations and people who give be made more self-aware of the distinction between the two, because I think it is a crucial distinction. It's one that is the difference between humanizing the condition of someone and dehumanizing it. So I'm really glad that you pointed that out. And you know, on a broader scale, I think for me as a human rights activist, as a writer, the challenge becomes: do I prioritize the individual story and get assistance to the individual person that is before me or whose case that I know about? Even if it promotes a larger paradigm of pity and of superiority that fits into these known cultural tropes, right? Like, for example, like I'm working right now on the story of a rape victim in rural in Pakistan in the tribal areas, and you know, she's in a really difficult situation. She needs protection. She needs to be taken out of the area, and it's just a very heartrending story that I'm working on. But at the same time, I know that telling that story in the way it's told, you know, sort of substantiates stereotypes about Pakistani women, about Muslim women, and it creates, you know, this sort of dichotomy where the West sort of appreciates its own affluence by looking down at the global South, and those larger connections and how, say, for example, that affluence is built on histories of colonialism and other, you know, forms of domination is not really teased out. So the conflict is one of time and understanding. I mean, on one hand, it's almost as if we're caught in this vicious circle, right? I mean, unless we tell the complicated stories, people are not going to get used to listening to the complicated stories. But then, you know, we worry that telling the complicated stories is going to make people not listen at all.
Right.
And that situation, of course, is a bad case for anybody who wants to expand humanitarian assistance or understanding. And that dichotomy is not always, you know, visible. Even in this, in these, you know, this AIDS satire, which is what they're calling this new genre, the danger, of course, is that some people will think, for example, that all the children who are featured in these videos are actors.
Right.
You know, and that will sort of, create mistrust among donors, and that they won't be able to collect aid, and that is a very real fear, because you know, aid organizations rely on creating that trust and on that idea that whatever you choose to give is going to directly help make things better.
So this is fascinating and so important, and I think you actually have a recent piece on really just a kind of, I mean, there's obviously ongoing problems of women's rights in Pakistan, but you've identified a couple of things that have happened recently in Pakistan that are particularly problematic and kind of escalating. And I think this is a fascinating case study right here, because we're doing this right now. So we're going to take on the issue of Pakistani women rights on an American broadcast with all of the, built-in kind of parameters around that conversation. And I think especially when we look at the relationship between the United States and Pakistan, obviously there are all of these different factors. There is the human rights situation. There's the dysfunctional and codependent and abusive relationship between both governments and intelligence services. Then there's the fact that, you know, we've operated these incredible, you know, human rights violations through drone campaigns and all sorts of other covert forms of warfare in Pakistan. So this is a long way and contextual way of saying you've written a really great piece as well about these new problems arising for women's rights in Pakistan. I'd love for you to describe that piece. And then as an addendum to that, using that piece as a launching point, what is the best way for us to have that conversation and raise those issues, which you've done so well, without feeding these problematic narratives that you've also raised so well?
Yep. You know, you hit the nail on the head here in terms of my challenges when I'm writing or speaking in two different contexts. And the piece that you're talking about was a piece that I wrote right in the week after Women's Day, International Women's Day. You know, and I'd written a piece for, and this is in the Pakistani Press, about talking about iconic moments for Pakistani women and Pakistan's history. And then right after that happened, it just, you know, I mean, we had a horrible week in which one woman who was a rape survivor burned herself alive. Another woman who had
she burned herself. I'm sorry, she burned herself burned alive herself, because they had not taken action.
Right.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
Precisely. I mean, you know, she was in front of the police station where she had lodged a report against her rapists who actually accosted her and raped her on her way to college. She had been walking to classes to her college. She had filed a report. The five men had been arrested, and then they were just set free. And then when she found out that they had been set free, she set fire to herself in front of the police station as an act of protest for the fact that, you know, as a rape survivor, she could not get any justice in Pakistan. And there was another case literally that same week in which a young girl who had run away from her family and married a man of her own choice was kind of tempted back to come and visit her family. And, of course, as soon as she came, she was captured by her family and buried alive. And so there were those two cases. There was another case where protesting nurses outside one of the provincial parliaments in Pakistan were baton-charged by the police. Because the police didn't think that they should be out there protesting. So there was a piece focusing on a particularly horrific week in Pakistan, which right now, as you know, is in the throes of negotiating this quote-unquote peace with the Taliban,
right,
which is being supported by the United States. And yes, I mean, this is precisely where you see the dichotomy of stereotype versus reality. I mean, what you want to do is try to disaggregate truth from the stereotype and prejudice. And it's a very difficult thing to do because in stereotypes, there are truths. It is true that these things are happening in Pakistan. And it is a situation where women need global support. But the question becomes, what do you do when countries, and the U.S. is particularly complicit, use these sorts of humanitarian language and the language of aid to hide strategic motives? And that's the case in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We went in, the U.S. went in, quote-unquote, using this this veneer of, quote, liberating the women of Afghanistan. And, you know, they carried that over into their rhetoric on Pakistan. But, of course, it was an invasion that was, that was determined by strategic motives. Now the U.S. wants to withdraw. But the situation in Pakistan is extremely dire. And U.S. intervention can directly be pinned to the fact that activists like myself and many other activists in Pakistan who work on women's rights are unable to create internal reform in those countries because that cause has been so dirtied by U.S. strategic motives, right? So when you're going to say, we're going to help women in the village, but then we're going to bomb the next village with a drone, then women's rights becomes very directly tied to this imperialist and illegal intervention.
It's the same brand. I mean, that it's the exactly. same brand.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so the price, of course, is, and you can see it in that piece, is going to be paid by Pakistani women who have been, you know, dragged into this this without their consent. I mean, they never asked for U.S. help. They never relied on it. But now, you know, they're going to pay the price for it. They're going to pay the price for the fact that when the U.S. was not droning Pakistan, they tried to have projects in which they aimed to help women. So, you know, the bottom line is this, is that the problem with aid is that its primary motive often, and most often, is to appease the sense of compassion or the feel-good part of the donor. It's not necessarily geared to what the recipient actually needs. And you see this especially in the context of when aid accompanies what is otherwise a war effort, right? So in Pakistan and Afghanistan, you've got schools in villages that needed wells, and wells in villages that needed schools, and you've got these sorts of projects because they're the sort of projects that sound good. And, you know, having worked and been in an aid-receiving country, I can tell you that. I mean, aid promotes artificial economies. The projects are unsustainable because they're not tied to, you know, local needs. But then more than anything now, when aid has become this sort of attachment to war efforts, and military invasions have been covered in this veneer of humanitarian, you know, humanitarian interests and intention, you've got a dirtying of humanitarian work as a whole. And it's a tragedy. It really is.
No, that is so important. And you know, what you just, in fact, described was basically, you know, that is what counterinsurgency strategy is, actually, as articulated by the kind of architects of it, was really actually drawing that connection of local institution building and aid and development efforts along with fighting a counterinsurgency war, which is incredibly, I mean, the style of that type of fighting and all of the things that come along with it. So you've really explained the kind of humanitarian ideals either being distorted by the desires of the donor or just as kind of like a certain window dressing around a military strategy that obviously is not centered on those humanitarian needs. We just have about 30 seconds left, but if you had to kind of summarize, you've given us so much. What's the best place to start for us to kind of reorient the conversation, at least where it needs to go, besides obviously reading your great pieces?
Well, I think, you know, I wrote a piece just 3 weeks ago called The T-Shirt Revolution. And what that aims to is for aid organizations to also pay attention to trade regulations and other forms that, you know, prevent countries like Pakistan or Bangladesh or Vietnam from competing on the global market. I think aid organizations need to sort of orient themselves to those forms of global inequality and focus some of their advocacy in those areas because, you know, they move away from this dependence paradigm into one where, you know, other countries who have the ability. I mean, Pakistan and the U.S. are a great example. The U.S. requires more cotton than any other country. Pakistan is one of the biggest cotton producers in the world. You know, that is a relationship. That could be a relationship of parity where you're actually creating sustainable industries in these countries as opposed to these artificial aid economies and these, you know, and fomenting these paradigms of pity and these sort of orientalist stereotypes about the people over there. So I think that the focus really does need to shift to other forms of inequality that we push, that, you know, stronger the Western industrialized West pushes on smaller countries. And I think they will reveal new avenues in which advocacy can be directed for longer-term better results.
Well, thank you so much, Rafia Zakaria. Everybody should read her piece, Aid and Stereotypes, which is linked on the Majority Report website. We'll also put links up to the Norwegian videos that we were discussing. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on.
Thank you. Take care. All right, folks. We are going to take a quick 30-second break. Matt's going to give you some stories, take you into the better half, and we will keep going. I'm going to put on Mission Impossible. Is that right?
Yep.
All right.
That was almost perfect timing. I'm putting in my headphones right now. So
it's all right. Everything's good.
All right. So let's turn on. Oh, wait. We're still in the first half of the show. Let me get to. That's true.
Stories, buddy.
Let's do a story here. We are back. Let's get to this first, I guess. It's the breaking news from today is that the Prime Minister of Malaysia has held a news conference early this morning. And they're saying that basically with new data, they've pretty much determined what happened to the missing Malaysian airplane flight, MH370. They're saying that the last position was in the middle of the Indian Ocean, west of Perth, Australia. It is a remote location far from any possible landing site, said the Prime Minister. It is therefore with deep sadness and regret that, according to this data, the flight ended in the southern Indian Ocean. So it's pretty much confirmation here that this plane has crashed into the Indian Ocean. Hopefully, they'll find the black box and find out why this plane has crashed. Sadly, they believe also, obviously, at this point, that there's no survivors. It's just a very sad story.
It's incredibly sad.
Sad that, A, that these people passed away and died. Sad B, that there was this ridiculous speculation that the media, put together to, which was basically a ratings grab. Sad C, that these poor families had to wait so long for this quote unquote mystery to be solved. Just for them to get this news, you know, I'm sure a lot of them had hope. I mean, how often does this happen in this day and age where this plane goes missing for so long? I'm sure there was hope in their minds that somehow this plane landed somewhere, whether it was hijacking or not, and that their family members were safe and just unable to contact them. This puts to rest any of these conspiracy theories, though, as I mentioned. CNN said to report to you guys that there was no black hole that sucked this plane in. The plane did not fly into the heavens, as
really?
CNN also reported. It was a possibility, maybe, because they have to, you know, read these Twitter responses when they've got nothing else to talk about, but they realize that this missing plane is bringing them massive ratings. Other news stations are the same too. You're just as guilty as this ridiculous of this ridiculousness. And to the Malaysian Airlines who decided the best way to, you know, there's a few things you shouldn't do via text message. One, I would argue, is, you know, break up with your significant other. Another thing is, you know, maybe not fire an employee. You know, just some things that are not in our culture and our society today have been deemed, you know, not the proper manners, not the proper thing
to do. I just saw, I think it was on Veep, a guy breaks up with his girlfriend and he texts her, "You, me, sad face."
But, I mean, these are
some of the
things
right. Yeah.
Our society has deemed to be,
and rightly so.
And rightly so, yes. You know, just don't do it.
Yes.
And I'd like to also add to this list, you know, I guess if you're ever in the position where you have to inform families that their loved ones, mothers, fathers, daughters, brothers, sisters, significant others, husbands, wives, children, when you have to inform them via text, don't do it via text message, that you have to inform them that their loved one has.
So Malaysian Airlines informed the families.
Yeah, via text.
Via text.
Yeah, don't do it. Don't tell
everybody
them,
has
yeah,
just performed it so extraordinarily badly during this.
Yeah.
From the media to the Malaysian government, the Malaysian Airlines. I mean, it really, it's just kind of extraordinary.
Listen, I know there's the argument out there, because I've already received it for making a tweet earlier, that, you know, in these Asian countries, text message is much more of a communication norm. A lot of people contact via text
message. This isn't a communication norm.
Yeah.
People have just died.
You contact these people individually and let them know the news. There's no way to text in a proper form. Your family members who were in that plane are dead.
We got some good news. We got some bad news.
Yeah.
Good news, plane found.
Bad news.
Well,
everyone's dead. Everyone's dead. You don't do that.
No. This is, I just want to say to really hit this point home, and I know I've said it before, but the big world, small world, macro, micro version of this story is in some ways always been what's been most, that's actually been what's most fascinating about it to me. And the way that this turned into this kind of global spectacle, not just a media spectacle, governmental, you know, military mystery and search. And, you know, I think to be fascinated by it is fine, but this group of people who have had to have assumed the worst for weeks, but not had closure. I mean, my heart really goes out to them. I mean, and then it all to end this way with the horrible news delivered over text message. I mean, they have been so failed.
Yes.
It's just extraordinary.
Yes. And sadly, I don't think these conspiracy theories are over because
– No, never.
Because you have this – the prime minister said in conclusion as to – on how they came to this conclusion, UK Air Accidents Investigation Branch and satellite firm Inmarsat, basically, according to the prime minister, performed further calculations on the data and using a type of analysis never before used in an investigation of this sort. And that's how they came to this conclusion. And you could just hear the light bulbs in all the conspiracy theorists' head and any of the scam artists out there who try to make money off of this. They're going to say, never before used. Just this unbelievably sad story that took numerous turns for the worse that were unnecessary.
Absolutely.
Do we have time for one? You know what? Maybe we should go to the better half. What do you think?
Okay. You know what? Yeah. Better half. We want to just get some quality time with the members.
Yes.
It's
members.
Time.
Little you and me time, members.
Yeah. All right, folks. You can support this show by becoming a member at the Majority Report today. Click on Become a Member. There's many different options. If you don't want to join through PayPal, which I know some of you don't, and I have to tell you, to be honest with you, I can relate. You can email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will get right back to you and explain to you another way you can become a member.
Yep.
But the easiest and most direct way is to just go on the website, sign up through PayPal. People, it's way easier than you can imagine. Take you less than 5 minutes, become a member. That's how the show survives.
Members also get the positive sorts of stories, ones that, you know, aren't so down in the dumps, terrible to hear. We will lift your spirits as we talk about the UK banning books to prisoners.
We're doing a Sam Cedar style fun half.
No, but we also got this hilarious story that will tickle all of your hearts. About creationists demanding equal airtime.
Equal airtime.
Because there is
a
story that uses scientific-based fact called the cosmos. Called cosmos. Just cosmos.
It's an update of the Carl Sagan thing from the 80s.
With Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yes.
And they're demanding equal airtime. We also have this hilarious story about a certain senator who thinks the Koch brothers are the most patriotic Americans in history.
That's something else. Also, Turkey's prime minister has taken Twitter down. I'll explain to you why that's not exactly working, but why he wanted to do it. The prime minister took it down, and the president of the country actually tweeted about it after he took it down, which is sort of funny.
Didn't he also say something funny like we'll talk about it in the
fun half. Yeah, we'll talk about it in the fun half. It's very funny. Also, Jimmy Carter thinks the NSA is monitoring him, possibly. And Duke Energy in North Carolina looks like they're going to be totally – well, I'll tell you about that.
So go to support the show in other ways too. MajorityReportKickback.com. We can buy all your stuff through Amazon. JustCoffee.coop. Use coupon code MAJORITY. That supports us as well, and you get a discount with that one. You can also support this show by downloading the app, if you haven't already, at MajorityApp.com. If you have downloaded that app, get others to download it. Like us on Facebook, Facebook.com/MajorityReport. Follow us on Twitter, at MajorityFM. Subscribe to us on YouTube, YouTube.com/SamSeeger.
We're almost at 30,000. Help us get to
30,000. Can we get to 30,000 by the end of the week? End of the week? This week. Singular week.
And there's also additional content on YouTube, like
yes.
Everything You Need to Know in 3 Minutes, which I do.
We'll
We're
be doing
be
a
doing
few other ones.
Public
yep.
shaming themed ones.
Which you could only get
channel,
on our YouTube channel.
The YouTube channel is very, very active. It's a whole other way of experiencing and enjoying the Majority Report. Sign up today.
So here we go. Let's go to the better half.
We will
Freebies,
see
Freebies, see you tomorrow. Sam will be back. Members, we will see you in less than 5 minutes.
Hmm.
Setting up the pace.